welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. People are increasingly concerned about their free access to supplements and herbs, as they should be. The FDA continues to try to exert its influence over health supplements. It wants them to be regulated like drugs, and we all know how successful they've been at protecting us from drugs that cause extreme side effects, like death. As far as vitamins and herbs go, where are the bodies? In 1968, today's guest, attorney James Turner, was doing some investigating himself. He discovered that the FDA had 50,000 cards and letters in their files in 1968 opposing the regulation of dietary supplements. When he asked an FDA official about it, the official's response was, "That's 50,000 quacks." So here we are, 40 years later, and nothing has changed. Join us today as we find out the current status of supplement freedom with our guest, James Turner of Citizens for Health. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, Ph.D.
Thank you, Lena. We're all understandably worried about climate change. Information is churning away in our information age about what it means and what we can do. Reduce our carbon footprint, purchase carbon offsets when we can't, and support legislation that forces manufacturers to offer low greenhouse gas alternatives. Without these actions, scientists like those who sit on the Nobel Prize-winning UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change predict significant effects on public health, such as increased incidence of infectious disease. What I want you to recognize is that what I've described is a biased perspective on the problem that reflects an equally biased perspective on health generally. It takes some effort to see this as a perspective at all instead of simply the way things work. Purchasing products to lower our carbon footprint and greenhouse gas reducing standards for industry leaves in place the social processes that actually make those choices seem natural. I was reminded of this by a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences last week that looked at who benefits and who suffers from ecological damage. The damage these researchers identified is what's called in economics an externality, a cost or benefit from producing or consuming a product that isn't accounted for in its price. For example, the loss of forests increases damage from flooding. The timber company buys the land, cuts the trees, and is paid for the lumber. When heavy rains fall, there's little left to keep that water from wreaking destruction downstream. You should not be surprised to learn that nations like Bangladesh, with a low per capita income, bear the burden of damage and little of the benefit, while high-income per capita nations like the United States reap most of the benefit and little of the damage. This story of unequal exchange is an old one, much older than our current era of globalization. It really starts with the expansion of European imperialism centuries ago. Climate change is only one of the six so-called drivers of ecological damage that these researchers examine, but it is what has our attention and imagination right now. Thinking ecologically, it's easy to see how climate change is linked to the other drivers of ecological damage. Agricultural expansion and intensification, ozone depletion, deforestation, overfishing, and mangrove forest destruction. Ecological damage makes a place uninhabitable. This is damaged health in the most profound sense. As areas of nations become uninhabitable, some people will die, some will adapt, and others will migrate. Some will migrate from country to the city. Some will migrate with or without permission from one nation to another. While activists and political leaders and even some corporate leaders exhort personal choices and government standards that reduce our carbon footprint, few societies are preparing for the onslaught of mass migrations that is likely over the coming decades. No doubt activists and artists and some politicians will put on spectacular events to raise money for those who suffer. I can guarantee that no events will be scheduled to alleviate the social inequities that are at the root of these migrations. To do so would question the sanctity of market capitalism as a way to provide people with the things they need. It's that sanctity that makes it difficult for us to look beyond personal decisions about what we buy, both literally and figuratively, as solutions to what are clearly social and global problems. Let me be clear. These personal choices are far from irrelevant, but they are only half the picture. The other half is what we do together as communities that determines the alternatives from which we get to choose. The sanctity of the market and its operations create a world for us, a world of consumption that makes it look like what we buy brings health, what that commodities give us our health, that even health itself is a commodity, something for us to purchase. I invite you to examine your own health choices in order to see the social ecology in which they are embedded, then act to make that ecology healthier. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Thank you, Dr. Fawcett. Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is director of the Sustainable Health Institute at sustainablehealthinstitute.org. Now to our topic, supplement access, an update on proposed regulation. And my guest is James Turner, chairman of the board of Citizens for Health. He's a principal in the law firm Swankin and Turner, which represents businesses as well as individuals and consumer groups in a wide variety of regulatory matters concerning food, drug, health, environmental, and product safety matters. Turner has appeared before every major consumer regulatory agent, including the Food and Drug Administration, the Environmental Protection Agency, Consumer Product Safety Commission, and Federal Trade Commission, as well as the Department of Agriculture and the National Institutes of Health. Mr. Turner has served as a special counsel to the Senate Select Committee on Food, Nutrition, and Health and the Senate Government Operations Subcommittee on Government Research. Recently, Mr. Turner was the lead attorney on a successful petition to the FDA to reclassify acupuncture needles from Class 3 to Class 2 medical devices, permitting their legal importation and distribution. He's a graduate of the Ohio State University of Law, and we're very happy to have you with us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
Can I call you Jim?
Jim.
Oh, good. Let's start maybe just by bringing people up to date with who Citizens for Health is, and then go right to where we are now in terms of proposed regulation.
Citizens for Health came into existence in 1993 to fight the FDA effort to regulate dietary supplements. And between 1993 and 94, during those 2 years, when the FDA was seeking more regulatory authority to restrict dietary supplements, a counteroffensive was launched, and Citizens for Health was instrumental in generating almost 3 million letters to Congress, the largest number of letters they've ever received on any issue. And the DSHEA Act, Dietary Supplement Health Education Act of 1994, passed essentially unanimously, passed by unanimous consent in the Senate and overwhelmingly in the House, and became law signed by President Clinton that October. And since then, the United States has had the most open access law on dietary supplements in the world, and we're working to keep it that way.
There have been several attacks trying to dilute or destroy the effect of the DSHEA Act. And I don't know that we have to go through all of them, but I think we should at least come up to the present and give people, because, I mean, every time there's an attack, we put stuff on our website, you guys have stuff on your website, and everybody gets people to email in, and we back it down. But it's constant.
It's constant. It's a constant attack, and it's very interesting. In 1968, when I wrote the book, I was working on the book, The Chemical Feast, which was published in 1970. That's the NADA report on food protection at the FDA. And we went in and looked at the dietary supplement issue. It was shocking. I mean, the FDA has been after dietary supplements since, 1939 or 1940. And they have systematically launched efforts to restrict them, which have systematically been either thrown out by the courts or beaten by politics. After Deshaies passed in 1994, FDA very shortly began working with the World Health Organization, not the World Health Organization, but the World Health Organization's Codex Alimentarius, which is a voluntary group of people, of countries, to create regulations or guidelines for how countries should regulate products. And the FDA worked very closely with the Codex to try to come up with a restrictive dietary supplement recommendation. In 2005, a moderately restrictive guideline was adopted by the Codex, and it was adopted with the support of many of the leaders of the dietary supplement industry in the U.S., much to the chagrin of a lot of the consumers. There was a very interesting effort of FDA.
Why do you think that is, that the industry caved like that?
Well, I don't think caved is exactly the right word, because what happened is an extraordinarily restrictive proposal was made by Germany, and that proposal, just to give you a flavor for it, would have restricted recommends that countries restrict the sale of dietary supplements to forms that do not exceed the recommended dietary allowance.
The RDA.
This is a very, very low amount.
Which is made up.
Made up by politics. It's fascinating to watch that operation work. But in any case, the industry representatives who were involved in Codex were able to pull together some resources and stop the effort to be that restrictive. On the other hand, they did accept things such as the need to prove the safety of dietary supplements. When I say they accepted it, there was a note basically put into the guidelines saying that an international body would come up with safety standards for dietary supplements. This is the key part of Deshaies. Deshaies says you can't regulate a dietary supplement unless the government has clear and convincing evidence that it's harmful. So they have to step forward and say, we've shown that it's harmful, therefore we get to regulate it. Puts the burden of proof on the government. The Codex guideline would actually move the burden of proof back to the manufacturers of the dietary supplements, but they at least were able to retain the high-level uses. They were not thrown out across the board the way the original proposal was made. And so there was what I say is that that the ball got to about the 40-yard line, and we're waiting to push it over the goal line by getting international countries to recognize the responsibility of government to establish that there is a safety problem with the dietary supplement before they regulate. And that's the fight we're in right now. And we're going country by country, asking countries to adopt that standard rather than the Codex standard.
We've interviewed Robert Verkirk a number of times from the Alliance for Natural Health, who's kind of in the courts battling with the European Union over all of this stuff. It's very odd that the EU, which is very, very good on certain issues, maybe that's the Jeffrey had a comment on that, huh?
I was going to go on that. When you were talking, and actually one of the things that I was contemplating here is one of the recent things that is quite good that happened in Europe is I forget what this acronym stands for, but the acronym is REACH, which covers the chemical industry. And it's an application of the precautionary principle that says that the burden of proof is on the industry before they introduce a chemical into production.
Right.
And that's the way that's going to work is that right now any new chemical that gets introduced, they have to show that it doesn't cause harm. And over, I think it's a decade or so, they have to show anything that's currently in the market. Nothing gets grandfathered in. It has to be demonstrated that doesn't have harm. So this is an application of the precautionary principle. And listeners who are sensitive to this might think, well, gee, maybe that really is a good idea that supplements, we should assume that supplement manufacturers, just like chemical manufacturers, should show that their products are safe.
Yeah, what occurs, they already have shown.
That's exactly the point. The point is that there's prima facie evidence that chemicals introduced into our environment are harmful, and there's prima facie evidence that nutrient supplements are not harmful.
Right.
So I want that point to be extremely clear in people's minds as to there's a significant difference here between what do we already know about these products, about these two very different kinds of products, that what's going on with REACH is not the same situation as what we face with dietary supplements.
Well, that is the core reality that needs to be elevated to the top of the debate. We need to make it very, very clear from a public policy point of view that chemicals derived from the industrial processes that actually retrieve byproducts and use them in food are a completely different world. It's an industrial world from materials that are derived from agricultural products, most of which are essential to human life. If one of the things that's going to happen in Europe has developed something that they call a positive list. You have to fight to get on the positive list. Now, this is separate from the Codex rules that I talked about. This is what Dr. Verkerk is fighting in Europe, is a positive list that says, unless you're on this list, you cannot be a dietary supplement. And what's happening is hundreds of products that have been sold for years will be going off the market on December 31st, looks like 2011 now, perhaps. I can think it's December 31st, 2010, January 1st, 2011. And the result is that all kinds of products that are currently available will be no longer available if the order that Europe wants to adopt is allowed to go into effect. But the basic point you just made, the distinction between an industrially based process and an agricultural based process, is key to everything that we're talking about in food food quality, safety, and health today.
Yeah, but there are two issues that we get stuck with. One is that dietary supplements, for the most part, and this is very confusing for people, I've noticed, are made by pharmaceutical companies because they're pharmaceutical grade. And people think, oh, my goodness, but you can't, that's no good. You know, they're going to be all bad stuff. But the truth is that they're bioidentical to the nutrients that can be extracted from food. And the reason for getting them that way is that when you extract vitamins from food, you're really highly processing the food in a way that sort of denatures and destroys the value of the nutrients, and you get very few of the nutrients through in the vitamins themselves. So the dosages of vitamins in food-based vitamins are very low. And in fact, when you eat food along with vitamins, you take vitamins, you eat food too, you're getting all your coenzymes and enzymes and various things that you need to be able to process the vitamins correctly. So nobody in their right mind, I would say, takes vitamins instead of eating. But what happens is that because there are pharmaceutical companies producing them, and it was at least that one incident, and I might add here that on some shows I've dug through and sort of come up with the statistics on how many deaths and adverse reports there have been with vitamins compared to pharmaceuticals, and it's daunting. I mean, there's really almost nothing with vitamins. Most of the adverse reporting, if you just stop taking the vitamin and the dose you were taking, it reverses itself rather quickly. There was the one case of the one very disreputable Japanese pharmaceutical company that was producing tryptophan that was genetically modified, and nobody talks about the fact that it was genetically modified. They just talked about the fact that here comes tryptophan, it made all these people really sick, and bad, bad, bad vitamins.
Well, and then they attacked all of tryptophan, and did not just single out that one lot of that one company, and so all tryptophan got caught up. And interestingly enough, at the time that occurred, you could get a tryptophan dose for about a nickel. You can now get tryptophan again, but it's about 95 cents. So it's an interesting event that has occurred by this what is, in my view, and what I've been able to review, is essentially a totally misguided regulatory effort.
Well, and if I'm not wrong, in my understanding or my viewing of it, the tryptophan incident was almost the only. I mean, there might have been one other. I can't even remember anything else like that's happened. I mean, how many times has Tylenol been taken off the market? How many drugs have been taken off the market, and how many times has this happened with vitamin supplements? I mean, they've done things like stop people from putting the herb ephedra in things, because in high doses it's like taking speed.
Well, they've now you know, won their court case to get ephedra off the market completely.
Yeah, but I mean, that's also very different than, I mean, it's like, anyway, I'm just saying the inequity.
Well, the thing about ephedra that always intrigued me is that when it began to appear on the market and become, you know, people really liked it, there were lots of reports that it had been laced with amphetamines.
I wouldn't doubt it.
So that it was being used as a cover to
to
get a street drug, you know, basically a designer drug market going, and that's a bad thing. I mean, I want the FDA to regulate that sort of thing, but I don't want them to mistake going after amphetamines that are in ephedra as going after ephedra.
And you make a very good point in on the website for your law firm, which is. Swankin Turner.com?
Right.
Okay.
Swankin-Turner.com.
You can find two speeches that you gave, and you talk about this what we do want the FDA to be responsible for that they're not doing, and what they are doing that we don't want. So that's very clear. Jeff had something?
Well, one of the things that maybe this is an appropriate place to point out as well is the kind of regulation that the FDA is trying to get in the business of doing is not the same as ensuring the purity of the product itself. I mean, that's this ephedra thing. You know, what it says on the label is in it is in it. That's certainly an appropriate form of regulation. We want to make sure that what we're buying is in fact what's in the package. That is very different from the FDA stepping in and saying this has health effects. We have to presume that it has deleterious health effects, bad health effects, unless proven otherwise. So that's not what this fight is about. The fight isn't about making sure that what it says on the label is actually in the product. It's about getting access to the product itself.
Right, and what's very important about that point is that FDA and all regulatory agencies, incidentally, it's hard work to establish whether or not a particular lot of a product is contaminated or whether or not a particular product has inside of it what's on the label. It's relatively easy, comparatively easy, to write a regulation that says, unless you get permission from us to do this, then we're going to punish you. And that's what they do in all of the things that they try to do. They want the violation to be failure to get permission from the FDA. So then you apply to FDA for something, and it's years before you get an answer. And one of the serious problems that would happen if they did that with dietary supplements would be a significant lessening of the availability of what are basically essential nutrients for health. And it is such an unsound regulatory policy that it's shocking to me that they continue, after all these years, to continue to push it.
Incidentally, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness, and this is an interview with James Turner, attorney and chairman of the board of Citizens for Health at citizens.org. And we're discussing supplement access and updating what's happening with proposed regulation. Yeah, and they're also trying, you know, this will also make dietary supplements very, very expensive, and it will also push, because they're also regulating dosages as if it was a drug, they're also increasingly popping up pharmaceutical companies who are marketing synthetic forms of fat-soluble vitamins like vitamin E and vitamin D. And there's kind of mixed research now coming up about vitamin D. Vitamin D in general, vitamin D2, which is the synthetic form, has been shown to be toxic at high doses because there were some early mistakes made when they added it to milk. So we know that's not a good
thing. In fact, I singled it out in the chemical piece as a serious food additive problem.
Although I note that some vitamin companies are adding it back in because I think there's been some additional research that shows that you can use it in proper dosages or anything. But anyway.
I don't know the current status of the vitamin D battle. Yeah. What I do know is that it was a very big issue starting. It was the first thing that FDA went after in the early 1940s. There was an effort to fortify Quaker oats, Quaker farina, actually, and the FDA cracked down on them, so they couldn't do it, even if they said farina fortified with vitamin D. They were not allowed to do that, and in fact, one of the reasons that we have the kind of a split that we do between fortified foods and dietary supplements is that the FDA was very successful in coming up with very strong regulations against adding nutrients to food, but they were not able to come up with strong regulations to block people's access to dietary supplements. They tried. In the early 40s, they tried again in the 60s, and they tried again in the 70s. And each time, they were met with the kind of outcry that I described from Citizens for Health in 1994.
Mm-hmm. Well, and point being that increasingly access to, water-soluble vitamins having a synthesized bioidentical form is okay. When you start getting into fat-soluble vitamins, it's much trickier to produce mm-hmm. them without screwing them up. I think I can say that on the air. And so that's another concern is that you'll start to have no access to the original forms of these things.
The issue that we're really addressing, the overall issue, is who makes the decisions about what it is that consumers get to consume. And the first point that I made in the Chemical Feast was there's a difference between dietary supplements, which are basically essential nutrients. There are probably 50 essential nutrients at this point that we know of, and there are probably many, many, many more. But essential nutrients should not be regulated in the same way that not essential chemicals are regulated. We have to come up with a different way of regulating, and we've been doing that, piecemeal with these fights. The situation, the animosity of FDA toward these products is so bizarre that in about 1999, 2000, they proposed a regulation that would shift a whole bunch of what we came to call stages of life conditions from natural conditions into disease. So they put pregnancy,
yes.
Menopause.
Right. No, we knew that.
Now we generated a battle against that and generated 300,000 letters to FDA and told them we were going to sue them if they did it. And ultimately they withdrew it. But to think of the reason they wanted to do that was if they are a disease, then in order to make a claim, you have to get approval by the FDA.
Well, and then you get to have drugs.
That's another a very important point is that there's been huge restrictions. It's been impossible, virtually impossible, to get reimbursement for dietary supplements. But there's reimbursement for all the drugs that compete with dietary supplements. So people who are out there go to, they want to buy something and they can get drugs essentially free, but they have to pay for dietary supplements. A lot of people go for the drugs. And there are actual lobbyists in Congress who battle against allowing dietary supplements to be reimbursed on third-party payment bases.
Well, it's no secret that the FDA has a relationship with the pharmaceutical companies. I mean, that many people have left the FDA and ended up working in the industry, in the pharmaceutical industry.
And vice versa.
And
many
vice versa.
Come from the industry and work for the FDA.
Yeah, no secret. There's plenty of good books about this. Marsha Angel book, The Truth About Their Drug Companies,
mm-hmm.
Makes the hair stand up on your arms. So that's no secret, and they are doing a good job of protecting them. We're going to need to take just a brief musical break, but when we come back, I think what I'd like you to do, Jim Turner, is talk a little bit more about where we are right now and what's catching up to us and right behind our shoulder now. So we're going to take a brief musical break. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. I've got James Turner, Chairman of the Board of Citizens for Health. And when we come back from the break, we'll continue with this interview about supplement access and update on proposed regulations. Stay with us. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, Ph.D. We're doing a show with James Turner, Chairman of the Board of Citizens for Health at citizens.org, on supplement access and update on proposed regulation. There's information about our guests, our practice, the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to big box medicine, and a free stream of this week's show, and there's lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number is 707-874-2772, and you might be watching the sustainablehealthinstitute.org website for information about forming local chapters of this wonderful new nonprofit. So let's get back to our interview with James Turner. Where are we now?
We are waiting for an attack on Deshaies. So far, they've been threatened, but so far no one has seriously undertaken to do that, and there is a coalition to preserve Deshaies that has been formed, and we believe that we're going to be able to win that battle, but everybody needs to be standing by and ready to engage once it happens. The big issue that is right now percolating, and I think FDA and its allies are counting on it to be its forum for winning its battle, is through the Codex Alimentarius. This is that international voluntary group. It's got about 170 countries in it, and they make recommendations to nations about how to regulate all kinds of things in the food area. And dietary supplements have, as I said, been put on their list, and they have made a recommendation. The next thing that's happening is that the International Food Safety Agency is, the one that looks at food chemicals safety, is working on a guideline for how to determine the safety of dietary supplements. That is going to be a huge battle. They're so conceptually confused because you can't apply the same kind of thinking to dietary supplements that you can to chemicals that are created chemically from the oil industry, essentially. That's where most of these chemicals come from. For example, there's a very nice paper done by some UN advisors showing that in the metals area, these are nutrient metals, copper, zinc, and so forth, that you can have numbers that are harmful to some people and essential to other people. We're arguing that you cannot regulate dietary supplements on a population-wide basis. You have to break it down really all the way to the individual, that every individual has a biochemical individuality, very much like fingerprints. And that if you try to force the public into some kind of predetermined guidelines on the basis of scientific evaluations, you will end up harming some segment of the population. Now, they've gotten that idea finally strongly enough that there are about 20 different subsets, so that there are children and adults and pregnant women and so forth, all of which have different dietary supplement numbers that are essential. But the amounts that people consume are even more particular than that, and there's nothing in these regulations that are going to be addressing that. What we're doing, Citizens for Health and a number of other groups, is working with countries around the world to have them adopt regulations that are different from the Codex regulation.
Yes, I was wondering about that.
Countries like India and China are already on that path. That's half the world's population right there. And there are other countries, particularly some African countries, that are very unhappy. The basic premise is they want to preserve their natural healing modes. Now, I want to go on and say that we've been talking about nutrients, but there's one other component of the dietary supplement world that under Deshaies that's very important, and that's herbs. And herbs are regulated in the international world differently from dietary supplements. So the World Health Organization and the European Union each are coming up with specific guidelines on herbs. The European Union has adopted a directive which is very, very restrictive. In fact, we've gotten legal counsel to tell us that they think on the face it violates the World Trade Organization treaty, and we would like to challenge it. And we're working on pulling together a case to challenge that. That particular herbal process in the World Health Organization is a special committee to look at herbs. And again, the Herb Trade Association, which you it's called the American Herbal Trade Association (APA). They have a website, and they have a lot of very good information on what's going on generally in the herb world. And again, it's important to note the distinction between the two. And I, again, make my point is that herbs are not an industrial product, and they can't be regulated the way we regulate industrial products. In fact, this whole Codex operation came into being it started out as voluntary meetings between the World Health Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization, both UN organizations in the 50s, because they were concerned about the addition of industrial chemicals to the food supply. They were concerned. They thought it was a problem. And gradually, over time, it got eroded into making Codex be basically the haven for protecting that kind of debasement of the food supply.
What was the website for the herbal organization again?
It's the American Herbal Products Association, and I think you just have to Google it because I don't know the
American
website.
Herbal Products Association. Okay.
AHAP, APA.
I wanted to ask a question, Jim, about kind of to back up, rewind the tape a little bit, to the this organization committee that's investigating the standards for supplements. And to make the long story short, who's actually sitting at the table, and how do they get selected?
It's the International Chemical Safety Agency. I mean, it's maybe the Food Safety Agency, but they have a committee that is going to develop the safety standards for dietary supplements. We applied for that committee and did not get selected, as did several other people who we thought of as allies. It's a committee of scientists. They believe that their experience in chemicals gives them the insight on how to deal with dietary supplements. Their first report came out, and it was really you could see them struggling with the kinds of different kinds of problems that we're dealing with. If you take a chemical that's a cancer-causing chemical, and it causes, you know, we know that it maybe only causes cancer in 2 in a million people. FDA says if something causes cancer in less than 1 in a million people, it's considered safe. I mean, I find that to be completely nonsensical, but they do. They consider that to be safe. But if it causes more than one cancer in a million, then it's considered unsafe. Now, you can't do that with a dietary supplement. It doesn't work that way. First of all, I'm back on your statistics. Basically, there have been fewer than 100 serious side effects tied to diet to nutrient supplements in the last 20 years, compared to probably as many, you know, somewhere between 150 and 750,000 deaths a year from pharmaceuticals.
Right.
Now, the very idea that someone would say the two products ought to be regulated the same way demonstrates some kind of, you know, some kind of imbalance, some kind of thought imbalance that
And the cases in supplements, the principal one in supplements was iron supplements that children took because they thought they were candy. You know, they're sugar-coated iron pills that their mothers were taking to supplement iron, and the kids overdosed on them. I mean, that's the vast majority of those deaths.
Yeah, so, and that is even speculative. That's not in many of the instances where we have a dietary supplement serious side effect or death. They've been looked at by many groups, including the General Accounting Office and the RAND Corporation and others, and it's very, very difficult to trace a causal connection between the reported adverse event and the dietary supplement consumption, because they consumed other things as well. And they were in a situation where these were very rare. It was a very rare thing. Now, in the iron situation is complicated by the fact that some forms of iron aren't particularly useful even from a nutritional
point
of view.
That's exactly right. There's another issue, too, which is that as you were talking about the point, which I'm so happy you made, of people being so individual in terms of dose dependency and what they need, is that there are genetic variants that people have that block the use of a certain thing, or where a certain nutrient might be irritating to them, might interact. It just has to do with the way their pathways work or don't work. And that's why people should be allowed to evaluate these things for themselves, because for the most part what happens when somebody takes something that doesn't work for them is they don't feel good and they stop. And it could, even in cases where, you know, I had somebody come to me for a consult who is on a pharmaceutical version of vitamin D, like dog, and was taking a dose which I knew from research in the past it was shown to be toxic. And I mean, truthfully, if you just stop taking it over a period of time, for the most part, not across the board, the results, most of the things will reverse themselves over time, which is unlike what happens when a pharmaceutical kills you.
Well, and also, you know, the vitamin A issue is the one that always intrigued me.
Yeah.
Because basically, the argument they make is that vitamin A creates a condition that mimics a brain tumor, and therefore you might mislead the physician believing you have a brain tumor. That is not the same as creating a brain tumor.
No, and also, it's very important to understand that vitamin A, we were just talking about vitamin D, vitamin A and vitamin D have a handshake. So if you're taking extra vitamin A, you need to take extra vitamin D.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding the basic sort of organic milieu of these substances and how they work together is very, it's not hard to get people to understand these things. I mean, if worse comes to worse, people can take a multivitamin where things are in the right ratios to each other, although there's less variation in terms of individual need. But these things have handshakes, and if you don't honor the handshake and then you suddenly get a thing, then there's always a newspaper article on the front page saying, oh, vitamin A causes bone loss because they weren't taking enough vitamin D to go with the vitamin A or whatever, or the liver or whatever.
And that's right. And the issue that I want to focus on that seems to me to be really important is that the regulators keep wanting to step in and make a judgment for all people. They want to make a rule that governs all people. And I don't think they should do that, but that's not my argument. My argument is they can't. They may believe that they're doing that, but when they do that and make a rule that's going to cover everyone, they are going to screw up a very large percentage of the population.
Very much so.
Now, in the industrial chemical side, there is some of the same kind of issue about individual variants. Everybody doesn't get cancer from a carcinogen. However, the problem you're dealing with for the benefits that you get is so extreme that nobody should have to face cancer in their food supply because a chemical has been added to keep it lasting longer on the shelf or whatever the marginal purpose that's been described for it. I'm very critical of NutraSweet. I mean,
going to get to that.
Well, there's no doubt that NutraSweet is causing brain tumors. I mean, there's just no doubt.
Right.
The argument that the industry is making is you haven't yet proved it conclusively.
Yeah.
And that's the same argument that cigarette guys made. There were 50,000 studies showing a correlation between cigarette smoking and lung cancer, and they were still saying you haven't shown a causal connection. And they'll go on with NutraSweet forever saying that you haven't shown a causal connection. Basically, what I would like to do is to require the companies to put all the data about a lack of safety of NutraSweet on their websites. Just put it there so people can go look up NutraSweet, and they would find every paper that's ever been written about NutraSweet, and they can look at them. They're going to have them summarized. If people knew the risk that they were taking, I believe there are large numbers of people who would not take, would not eat NutraSweet or Splenda for that matter.
You are listening to an interview with James Turner, chairman of the Board of Citizens for Health at citizens.org, or if you'd like to download a couple of his lectures, they are on the website for his law firm, Swankin, S-W-A-N-K-I-N, dash, Turner, .com?
.com,
and you'll find his articles, his these two speeches, which are quite good to read. And this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I want to finish with the artificial sweetener thing before we go back to the regulations. The Splenda, I think I understand that there's a pending lawsuit about Splenda.
Well, there is a major lawsuit in California brought by the sugar industry against Splenda for its statement, made from sugar tastes like sugar. NutraSweet, interestingly enough, brought an lawsuit in Philadelphia about a year ago on the same grounds, and ultimately the jury was deliberating, and they said, please send us a calculator so we can figure out the award. And the Splenda folks rushed to the judge and said, we'll settle. They settled for $20 million, apparently.
Ooh.
We don't know that for sure, but it looks like $20 million. And then they got into a fight about whether they would pay the $20 million, so NutraSweet and Splenda may still be fighting. And there's another one like that in California. And Citizens for Health has filed a petition at FDA asking them to withdraw their approval of Splenda. It has a number of health problems, as well as it's an environmental disaster. Basically, there's an Olin plant down in the town where this stuff is made that ships chlorine across town to the Splenda factory, where they shoot Splenda onto sugar. Chlorine onto sugar and create a chlorinated hydrocarbon, which they call Splenda. And you know, that's the same body of that's the same family as DDT and every other chlorinated hydrocarbon that exists has eventually turned out to be harmful.
Sprinkle some pesticides on your breakfast cereal if you don't already have them in the breakfast cereal.
And then the principle upon which it works itself should make people pause, because basically what it does, it's in little pellets. It's little tiny, very very hard pellets that can't be digested into your system. It goes through your upper digestive tract and down into your lower digestive tract. It's like taking sandpaper and small grain sandpaper, scraping off the little granules and then swallowing them. And it does to the lower intestinal tract basically the same thing that the lactose intolerance does to the lower intestinal tract. The product is not digested in the upper tract. That's why it doesn't have any calories. Goes into the lower tract and starts to abrade and create ulcers. And some of them are very, very bad, very serious ulcers.
Artificial sweeteners have never been shown to really successfully prevent people from gaining weight or help them lose weight either.
Quite the contrary. Every study that has been looked at with any rigor and care suggests that people use the dietary supplement as an excuse for eating more calories. So they get a cake and a diet soda. And weight goes up when you use them.
Yeah. Okay, so I've had a few people phoning me worried about something that Senator Kennedy is proposing. I've had people say, oh, there's this, that, and the other thing. But I've not found anything either on your website or the Alliance for Natural Health, ANH.org. The only thing I do know is that you guys, this is under the category of strange bedfellows, reminding us that this issue of supplement freedom is very bipartisan. Ron Paul has a very important proposal, Ron Paul's Health Protection Act, which you are asking people to support. Why don't you explain? We usually don't think of, most of the people listening to this station don't usually think in terms of wanting to support Ron Paul, but he's proposed something good.
He's an odd fellow in that regard. He's a pure libertarian, and in this particular instance, getting the FDA off the back of dietary supplement users and people who want to use alternative medicine is a libertarian issue. And we have a constituency that cuts all the way across the political spectrum from extreme right to extreme left and everybody in between. People who have had the experience of finding an alternative health approach or dietary supplement approach or herbal approach to their well-being turn out to not be identified with a single political party.
Good thing.
Right, good thing. Ron Paul is kind of like the Dennis Kucinich of the right. And he does believe in the Constitution, and he has been very good on all of these health access issues. And this particular bill that he's pushing, and by the way, we generally suspect that a bill by Ron Paul has about as much chance of getting through Congress as a bill sponsored by Dennis Kucinich. and there are sometimes when the two of them sponsor the same bill. But the point that he's working on in his bill is to create the opportunity for individuals to have access to the full variety of alternative medicine and dietary supplement modalities that are available, and that the FDA cannot intervene, government cannot intervene, including through the international organizations, unless they have strong evidence of harm. Mm-hmm. And then they can act to do that. This does not interfere in any way with the responsibility of the FDA to ensure that what is in the package is what the package says on it. That's a different kind of regulation, and as Jeff was pointing out, and that's really, really important to know. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do and what Ron Paul is trying to do is to make the policy of what I eat a policy that I adopt, not a policy that the government adopts.
Well, and so I think what we can say to listeners is if you are concerned that there's an issue coming up and you want to be kept aware of what's going on, join citizens.org, Citizens for Health. Go to their website, bookmark it, send them some money to join, and you will get constant updates on what you need to act on. And you guys have been so effective, as you said, since 1993 or even before that.
But
so,
let me make one point. You don't have to pay any money to.
Oh, you don't have to support. You can just join.
But you'll get asked to make a contribution. But there's a $35 membership fee, but membership, it has some extra benefits. But in terms of getting on the website and getting the information,
it's
and
free access.
Learning what's going on, free access.
Free access. Now, I have a question for you, because this is so on my mind all the time now, as we're seeing this proliferation of radio frequency radiation, cell phone towers going up and antennas going up in municipalities covering cities and wireless and all of this push by the telecommunications companies. I'm seeing a very similar problem to all the other stuff we've been, same thing as what we've been talking about. There is proof of harm that exists. But the industry saying, oh, no, it's not conclusive. We can't. It's the same thing the cigarette industry said. And it's like everything else. It's like the chemicals in the environment and everything else. And they have right now, there's nobody pushing back against them. I wonder if you want to say anything about that.
Well, it's a horrendous problem. And I want to say that I believe that it is any specific example of the general problem I've been talking about. The culture that we've organized does not actually create institutions to protect its people. It creates institutions to protect markets. And I was listening to an NPR radio newscast or interview or something, and they had a guy on who was a consultant to the cell phone industry, and he said that we should not be concerned about cell phone safety because all the tumors they found on the cell phone side were benign. Now, I'm listening to this guy and I'm saying to myself, whoa, what is that?
Oh, well, that's okay then.
Yeah.
Well, and also they're not all benign. There's just a very long latency period.
Yeah, and you won't die. You'll just get Alzheimer's disease.
Or some, certainly. Yeah.
Or, you know, you'll lose your motor skills.
But the thing that's so problematic about this is that there's a question that I've been looking into this a bit, and we're trying to figure out a policy that we can take that will help.
That would be good.
Restrict the damage. But one of the things that's not been looked at is whether or not there are benign frequencies that you could actually
exactly
carry the
exactly.
And there certainly appear to be. I mean, all the stuff I've learned appear to be benign frequencies.
Well, it would cost a lot of money to do that, and they don't have to do that. But the thing that makes me the most nuts about this is with smoking, You could choose not to smoke.
Right.
You could choose not to have smokers in your house.
Mm-hmm.
You could avoid restaurants when they had smoking restaurants. With wireless and cell phone antennas, you do not have a choice.
Yeah, right.
You will be exposed no matter what. And what somebody pointed out to me recently is that, because we're resisting in our neighborhoods around here, is that they just keep looking for different sites. They'll just find a private site to put it on, and they'll put it up there. And they can't be sued for health effects, so they're protected. And when they can, what they'll do is shoot more satellites into the
yep.
stratosphere, and then they'll just beam stuff down on us without having antennas, and we'll still be getting exposed, and we will not have a choice. And I'm thinking, when did this turn into a banana republic? You know?
Well, it's been there that way for quite a while. It's not... I mean, the United Fruit was doing stuff like this in the 1800s,
yes.
not necessarily shooting, shooting beams from satellites, but they were shooting other stuff that were pretty bad.
Yes, they were.
The whole question of this microwave community environment that we've created is very, very problematic. We need to think about it, and it's not been thought about. It's just been allowed to develop helter skelter and
money.
Yeah, and power and it's a game for a lot of these guys that run these businesses. I mean, you know, they don't really need the amount of money that they have. I mean, my God, they have billions of dollars. But they still keep perpetrating this. It's really interesting. Our building here is owned in part by the Cell Phone Trade Association. So it's kind of interesting to just be around these folks.
It's my observation of the broad range of issues that you're talking about. There's kind of three things that seem to be at play. There's a fascination with technology, so that, for instance, the health standards for wireless technologies have been set by engineers, not biologists. So there's the promoters of the technology get in. Then the money people get in. The second part is money people get in, and they see market opportunities and keep alternate perspectives from having a voice. And then, once government becomes involved, there's the famous revolving door problem of people. Where are you going to find the experts to perform in government? Well, they're the people from industry and the promoters. Mm-hmm. So there's this nexus that goes on that really is problematic.
Well, it's also built around a way of thinking that says that basically it's a dualistic type of thinking. Either things are safe or they aren't safe, or things should be consumed or they shouldn't be.
Yes.
And the problem with that is that just because you can't prove that something should not be consumed does not mean that you have shown that it should be.
Exactly.
Or used or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's the core problem that I see in each of the things you've pointed out. And we have no political resistance to that at all.
Right. We have to leave it there. I'm so sorry. But, you know, what we're asking listeners to do is to stay informed, and they can do that by going to our website, and they can do it by going to citizens.org. So people should stay informed, and you will keep people posted on citizens.org about which actions they need to take.
Yep,
there are even
yep.
some actions right now.
Yep,
so
that's right.
Well, we'll do that. So thank you so much, James Turner from Citizens for Health. At citizens.org. And again, if you want to read his talks, it's at swanken-turner.com. You can read his papers. And there's plenty of information at citizens.org. And you are so kind to spend this hour with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, our guests, our practice, the Progressive Health Observer, and a free stream of this week's show, and there's lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number is 707-874-2772. And watch in addition for information about forming local chapters of the Sustainable Health Institute, the new nonprofit at sustainablehealth.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.